Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Prosecutors unveil charges of seditious conspiracy in connection with the Capitol riot as Kevin McCarthy stiff-arms the January 6th committee. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, editorial writer Jason Willick and columnist Kim Strassel. More than 700 people have been arrested in the year since the Capitol riot, some of them charged with attacking police officers or obstructing official proceedings. But late last week, federal prosecutors dropped a more freighted charge, which is seditious conspiracy. It applies to 11 people, including Stuart Rhodes, the founder of this group called the Oath Keepers. Jason, you've read through the indictment here. Can you give us a sense of what it say and what is being alleged?
The operative part of the text of the statute is anyone who opposes by force the authority of the United States or by force prevents, hinders, or delays the execution of any law of the United States can be guilty of seditious conspiracy. So in this case, what's being alleged is the law of the United States said there's a peaceful transition of power, or that Congress does its job on January 6th. Pursuant to the Electoral Count Act and the Constitution to certify the presidential election. So what's being alleged is their actions in the riot delayed the execution of that law, the law of presidential succession. And none of these guys shot anybody, or I suppose they did brawl with police officers. It's alleged in the indictment that they had a quote-unquote quick reaction force waiting in Virginia, which means they had some people with weapons, but they were never called on during the riot. But nonetheless, that's alleged as part of the conspiracy.
And those pieces of the indictment seem a little alarming. I mean, I don't think Stuart Rhodes is accused of taking any firearms into D.C., but it says on January 1 and 2, he spent $5,000 on firearms and related equipment, including a shotgun, etc. On January 3rd, while he was traveling to D.C. and Texas, he spent about $6,000 on an AR platform rifle and firearms equipment. Then there was this group of his Confederates, allegedly, who were at hotels outside Washington, and I'll just read a piece of the indictment, awaiting a call to bring the weapons to the co-conspirators. They're talking, Kim, about, we're not going to get through this without a civil war. And so I can see why federal prosecutors are taking that seriously.
Yes, this certainly looks to be distinct from a lot of the other charges that have been brought. And let's be clear, the other charges that have been brought, the more serious ones, are very serious crimes. We've had a number of people charged with obstructing congressional proceedings. We've had a number of people charged with assaulting federal officers, people charged with damaging government property, and all of those charges hold penalties of up to 20 years in federal prison for engaging with them. What makes these distinct, as Jason very ably laid out, is simply the coordination aspect of it and the scope of what they were considering doing, and that they made plans to bring weapons. There was a lot of secured and encrypted chat messages between them talking about how they were going to operate. They obviously marched into the Capitol in these stack formations. It didn't really get them anywhere. They didn't manage to do, as far as I can tell, any more or less damage than any of the other rioters that day. And that's why, and we can talk about this, there are some eyebrows being raised about the seditious conspiracy charges, because these are charges that have been on the books, or the potential to prosecute them. Laws have been on the books since going back to the Civil War era. They were very much aimed at Confederate sympathizers in northern states who undertook to sabotage the war effort. They've really only ever been used a handful of times in the next 160 years. And in those cases, very much at very obvious examples, for instance, against jihadists who were U.S.-based foreign nationals that were very clearly here to wage war against the United States, who wanted to destroy our system and mass murder Americans. It's much more rare to see this, and some very good legal analysis has suggested that they could have trouble with these charges as a result.
It does seem like there's a lack of good precedence here. And one of the most recent ones, a set of charges, seditious conspiracy charges, I'll just read the result of that. This is a news story from 2012. 7 members of a Michigan militia were acquitted Tuesday of all major charges, including sedition and conspiring to use a weapon of mass destruction, after a federal judge said the prosecution failed to show the group posed a credible threat to the U.S. government. So we don't have a lot of good examples of what a prosecution under this law looks like, especially in modern times. Another thing that I've heard raised, Jason, is the idea of whether intent is required to prove this. If you read through the indictment, it seems clear that these guys were convinced by the rhetoric coming out of President Trump, for one, that the election was stolen and that a pretender was about to be inaugurated and put in the Oval Office. And does it matter, Jason, do you think? What do you make of this idea that in order to be convicted of undermining the U.S. government, you can't be under the delusion that you're upholding the U.S. government?
Yeah, a few things. I think you're right about the precedents. One of them was the Blind Sheikh case, having to do with the World Trade Center bombing in the 1990s. That was a seditious conspiracy conviction. Another one was when Puerto Rican nationalists actually opened fire in the Capitol, in Congress, in the 1950s. They were convicted of seditious conspiracy. I think Kim is right that it didn't really get these guys anywhere, their plans. And so there's sort of the question of, when you're talking about intent, well, what was their intent? You have somebody talking in this indictment about Milosevic, you know, the ruler in Serbia who was deposed. They're kind of saying, well, we're going to go into the capital, the government's going to fall. It seems there's an element of it that's kind of fantasy talk. And of course, there's a continuum between, you know, fantasy and action. And these guys took some action. But there's a question of what exactly was their plan beyond going into the Capitol. Again, these far-right groups sort of talk about the Civil War. They talked about, after January 6th, we're going to go to hundreds of acres in Kentucky with our guns and, you know, hold out there in Kentucky. And it's just kind of, to some extent, I'm sure their lawyers will argue this was constitutionally protected free speech in their messages that is really just playing out a fantasy that they're entitled to do, and they didn't actually do anything besides, you know, run into the Capitol, but they didn't take any real acts in furtherance of overthrowing the government. As to intent, they've got a DC jury. This crime, allegedly, if it is seditious conspiracy, it took place in DC. So you've got to go in front of a federal jury in DC, which is very Democratic. And I don't think, you know, very, very liberal. I don't think there's going to be much sympathy for the view on that jury that they thought that they were upholding the Constitution. I think the jury would be likely to reject that. I think the more promising defense for them probably is something to the effect that I went about earlier, that this was a fantasy, sort of like what you summarized from the 2012 seditious conspiracy case in Michigan, and also the current case involving Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, where people are being charged for attempted kidnapping. They're making a similar argument. This was just talk. This was not real.
Kim, you mentioned raised eyebrows at these charges, and part of the context here has been real dissatisfaction among a lot of Democrats about how these Capitol riot cases are being prosecuted. And here we'll play a short clip from Democrat Ruben Gallego of Arizona speaking shortly before the anniversary of January 6th.
Merrick Garland has been extremely weak, and I think there should be a lot more of the organizers of January 6th that should be arrested by now. The problem that we have right now is that we have a very obstructionist Republican Party that should be part of helping us decide how to save democracy instead of trying to cover up for their crimes. And you have, again, an attorney general who is, you know, feckless and has not been helpful in terms of preserving our democracy.
And shortly after that, Merrick Garland, the attorney general, gave his own speech on January 6th. And here's part of what he said.
The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6th perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. We will follow the facts wherever they lead.
So, Kim, what do you make of that argument that perhaps this is an example of Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, the Justice Department, trying to bring broader charges than it will really be able to prove in a court of law?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's just look at the claim that was just made in that clip, which is obviously nonsense. The Department of Justice has been very vigorous in its prosecutions, especially if you think about the speed with which justice normally works. They've charged more than 750 people in the course of a year. More than 165 people have already pled guilty. Trials are proceeding with others. That's actually pretty quick and pretty sweeping for, again, a branch of the federal government. So that's a bit nonsense. But you also then have to put this in the context of the broader Democratic narrative over the past year. And that helps explain their frustration, because while everyone in the first couple of weeks described this as a riot, very quickly, Democrats instead began to call it an insurrection, an act of sedition, an attempted coup. And this feeds into their broader claim that the entire Republican Party is full of violent extremists and bent on stealing elections and undermining the rule of law. That's obviously not the case, but they want very much to make it. And they've been very frustrated so far that the Department of Justice has not been able to supply them the evidence to make that case. We had very early indications from different federal offices that they were, in fact, having trouble. They could find no real evidence of much coordination at all between anyone, certainly not coordination driven by the highest levels, which is what Democrats were sincerely hoping for, that you'd get some secret messages out of the White House telling people to do this. They haven't found that. So the pressure has amped up on Merrick Garland to do more. And that's the source of these raised eyebrows, which is up until now, there has been mostly charges, as I said, about obstructing congressional proceedings, which is what these guys did too. So now to have the seditious conspiracy charges put on it, it does smack a little bit of potentially political considerations, the Department of Justice bowing to that. And it raises, as Jason explained, the very possible outcome that these might not stick. As Andrew McCarthy, a former prosecutor, said in a recent piece, he very clearly threw the requirements of intent, and he's prosecuted a case like this before, and suggests that the Department of Justice made a mistake here in that you've got guys who clearly were bad actors in this. But the government is potentially putting itself in a place where it doesn't get them on those top charges, and so looks as though it's losing a case against them, when it could have been on much more solid ground if it had gone with simply obstructing congressional proceedings.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. To Kim's point before the break, the other political advantage, it seems to me, of having seditious conspiracy now being charged is it is being taken as vindication for people who have argued all along since January 6th that this was not just a bunch of people who protests that got out of control. It was a more organized effort. So, Jason, what do you make of that? And the idea then that if this is a conspiracy, as the federal prosecutors are alleging, the question is, where does the conspiracy stop? How high does it go?
Yeah, on the political point, I'd just note, it's also worth noting that Bill Barr, the attorney general during the Trump administration in 2020, is said to have floated the idea of seditious conspiracy charges in relation to some of the riots on the West Coast in Portland. Because, I mean, this statute is broad, right? Anyone who hinders or delays the execution of any law of the United States using force, you can imagine a lot of protests, a lot of violent protests that are hindering the delay of the execution of laws. So, you know, it's broadly written, and politically, we're using a charge that's politically freighted. If we're going to have a period in this country, as some people think, of more protests and maybe even more political violence, it may be used in ways by both parties or by both, you know, ideological camps. You know, the kind of protests, your violent protests is sedition, my violent protest is a protest for justice, and so on. So that's worth considering as we think about this charge. That doesn't mean it's not warranted, but it's useful to think also, you know, dusting off this old charge, how else it could be used. To your point about, I agree with you completely, though, on the political messaging here, and it does vindicate people who, or at least they feel that it vindicates them, who said that this was not just a riot. This was more than that. As to the conspiracy and where it leads, I mean, I think it probably ends here. I think that these were the guys on their Signal group, and anybody on the Signal group was indicted, or, you know, talking on this Zello walkie-talkie app. It seems like they got all these people. I do think there's certainly an appetite, as Gallego hinted at, maybe to charge President Trump or people around him with something to do with the Capitol riot. Liz Cheney basically implied this in one of her remarks on the January 6th commission. I think what the charge she has in mind, or the one she implied, is obstructing Congress, that the president encouraged people to obstruct Congress. But as Kim said, you know, obstructing Congress kind of covers the same ground as this law, and which you choose as a prosecutor to some extent depends on sort of the message you want to send and how you see these acts in your gut.
Yeah, one last thought I would add on the question of how high the conspiracy goes. I would point people toward paragraph 77 of the indictment, and it is Stuart Rhodes again. He messages the leadership Signal chat, "Pence is doing nothing, as I predicted. All I see Trump doing is complaining. I see no intent by him to do anything, so the Patriots are taking it into their own hands. They've had enough," end quote. And Kim, I mean, that to me seems to answer the question of whether any of these people were in touch with people in Trump's orbit, and it suggests no. The other question I had is, what do you make of the fact that prosecutors have gotten their hands on all of these encrypted Signal chats and all these confidential communications? I mean, on one hand, that could be somebody within the conspiracy who has flipped and turned all that stuff over. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure these apps have functions where they delete messages after a certain period of time. So what do you make of just the details here in this indictment?
Yeah, it's unclear how they got a hold of these, because it's pretty complete, too. They have a lot of stuff. It's not very patchwork. It looks like they've got most of the communications. And so, you know, people have said, well, were they able to tap into that even though it was encrypted? Was there somebody working on the inside? Did somebody flip? More interesting to me is, when did they get a hold of this information? If it's only been since the riots, well, that's one thing. But this has to be viewed in the context of a growing discussion in Washington, especially as the January 6th committee ramps up, about security. A lot of Republicans, when they've looked at that committee, have been critical that there hasn't been more of a focus on whether or not there were intelligence lapses or a failure to communicate warnings to Congress and to the Capitol Police prior to January 6th. How much did the feds actually know? Did they pass it on? Could we have been in a better posture to push back these rioters, and so that this never got to the degree that it did? That's a question that a lot of people really want to know, and it certainly would seem to raise, this indictment would seem to further raise the need to get that information.
Well, that's a good transition to what the January 6th committee is up to, and the latest dust-up is between the committee and Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader. The committee had sent him a letter asking for voluntary cooperation with our investigation on a range of critical topics, including your conversations with President Trump before, during, and after the violent January 6th attack, unquote. And Kevin McCarthy has basically said he is not going to cooperate with the committee. And here's a clip of him.
On January 6th, I spoke to the American public, not by one network, but by many networks. My conversation was very short, advising the president of what was happening here. There is nothing that I can provide the January 6th committee for legislation of their moving forward. There is nothing in that realm. It is pure politics of what they're playing.
So the question now, Jason, seems to be, what will the committee do next? And will it try to subpoena not only a fellow member of Congress, but the minority leader of the Republican Party?
Beats me. I mean, with Steve Bannon, we had this contempt citation, effort to prosecute him for contempt. You know, it seems like we recommended at the time that if Congress wants to hold somebody in contempt, they can use the Capitol Hill jail. In fact, what they ended up doing was having the Department of Justice prosecute Mr. Bannon for contempt. So that adds a separate problem, which is, are you going to have the Attorney General of the Biden administration have arrested the leader of the opposition? for a contempt charge. I mean, that just seems like a bridge too far in terms of the appearance of political. I mean, that's a banana republic move to have your executive arrest the leader of the opposition. So it's hard for me to fathom that that would happen.
Kim, are you as confident that the January 6th committee won't try a subpoena, or are there other measures they could take to try to get Kevin McCarthy to comply with them?
Well, I think it's really important to note that this is absolutely unprecedented. A set of lawmakers acting to subpoena another set of lawmakers. Time magazine had a piece when they had this quote, "To my knowledge, a legislative committee or oversight probe has never done this," end quote, said Stanley Brand, who served as a House counsel from 1977 to 1983. And he noted that probably the closest thing you could get was in 1972 when a senator's aide was subpoenaed to talk about his role in the publication of the Pentagon Papers. The only other time that members have ever received a subpoena from fellow lawmakers is when they're under suspect of having violated ethics. And so there has been a couple of times where the House or Senate Ethics Committees have put out subpoenas for information or testimony from a member under active investigation. But it's never happened with a select committee. And also one, and I think this is where it gets so dangerous, one that is so lopsided. You know, let's not forget this committee consists of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Those 2 Republicans are incredibly hostile to most of the rest of their caucus. The history was that Nancy Pelosi set up a very lopsided committee. McCarthy objected. He then put members forward and she rejected his picks. So it is a little bit, it's a little shirty to then turn around and say, here's a committee that we wouldn't let you participate in, any members of your side, at least not your picks, and now you have to bend a knee and appear before us. I would also note that Jim Jordan and Scott Perry members have also objected. Jim Jordan's letter was very notable in that he didn't use the phrase itself, but it made clear that if they went after him, he was going to fight this legally, largely on the speech and debate clause, which does give most members a certain amount of immunity from these kind of investigations. So I don't think they have very strong legal grounds. And that's why, unlike what the committee has done in the past, where it moved very quickly whenever anybody defied it to strike back, it's sat on this now for almost a week, because I think even it understands its hands may be tied here.
Maybe that delay is signaling something. But Jason, it does seem to me like it would be an awfully bad precedent, and perhaps one that does not provide a lot of opportunities to be repeated, because how often is information held by a member of Congress relevant to an issue that a committee of Congress is investigating? I'm struggling to come up with a lot of other examples other than the Ethics Committee. But we have seen a lot of precedents broken in the House. Kim cited one, rejecting Kevin McCarthy's picks for this committee. Another would be kicking Republican members off of committees, removing their committee assignments on a one-party basis. And Kevin McCarthy, Jason, has already indicated that he intends to give as good as he gets when Republicans take back control of the House.
Yeah, it won't be pretty if we destroy these institutional norms any further. Kim mentioned the speech and debate clause, which gives members of Congress special immunity for when they're performing their official duties. That's also being invoked in another context in January 6th, as Eric Swalwell, the Democratic representative from California, sues Mo Brooks, the Republican representative from Alabama, for his speech on January 6th that he says incited the January 6th riot. So, you know, that's another kind of extraordinary situation. One member suing another over a speech. So we're gonna see these precedents sorted out in terms of the speech and debate clause. And I would agree that it's best that we don't. You know, we've had the January 6th attack was terrible and disgraceful for Congress. But it's best if we don't let it sort of tear up certain rules and guardrails that have made our Congress function such as it were for a long time.
My last thought here, Kim, is why doesn't Kevin McCarthy just answer some of these questions? The January 6th committee is not asking for his bank records or his tax records. You know, we've had litigation over whether houses of Congress can get President Trump's tax returns, but we're not talking about anything related to that. I mean, he got a call from President Trump. He spoke on the phone to President Trump during the Capitol riot. What did President Trump say? And Kim, we'll give you the last word here.
I think McCarthy would say 2 things in response to that. One, he's already publicly related that conversation. And that was one of his arguments to the January 6th committee, which is, you've already heard me relate my conversation with Trump and a couple of follow-up ones too. And so, you know, why do I have to come now and submit to further scrutiny from you, my fellow lawmakers? I think the bigger problem that McCarthy has too, though, this is, look, his entire caucus, and with some reason, is viewing this committee very skeptically, not just because it was how it was set up in the beginning, but because of what has been pursuing since then. It isn't just the singular focus on Donald Trump and what definitely looks like an exercise, as Jason said, to somehow land him in legal trouble in the end, but the fact that a lot of members feel that though there really was a security breakdown on that day, that there really was a major problem, and that part of the committee's job here should be a much greater focus on security and how you make sure this never happens again. That's supposed to be what they're doing. And instead, Republicans are viewing this more and more as a political exercise. So, you know, it would be very difficult for McCarthy, again, to bend a knee and submit to it when he has thrown so much cold water on its purpose and legitimacy otherwise.
And I think also Kevin McCarthy on January 6th did say President Trump bears responsibility. He said that after. And I do think he's felt the political need to retreat from some of his candid remarks after January 6th. And he feels that speaking to the committee would be politically damaging in terms of his subtle or maybe not so subtle shift in messaging about January 6th from the time that it happened until now.
Thank you, Jason and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.